Chris Whittingham is on the Toyota of Hollywood hotline. He's a soccer broadcaster for CBS and Apple TV. You can see him all tournament long on CBS Golasso. So what happened against Belgium? Because we were all excited by the USA, and they looked unlike anything we had seen in the tournament up until then. They looked amateurish.
Yeah, they did. Whatever insults you have, I will agree with. And it is incredibly startling after what they delivered in the first four games. And you can say it's a different level of opposition, and it was. But at the same time, the first game was against Paraguay. Paraguay made the last 16, beat Germany, and gave France a real run for their money. So I'm not saying that Paraguay's terrible. But for whatever reason, and I was sitting with a friend, I was at the game, and I just kept looking out and going, there's nothing about this that looks right. There's nothing about this that looks like they're up for this, that looks like they have any measure of confidence. All of the things, all of the details that made them good in the first four games were gone in 5 minutes. Their ability to pass in tight spaces, the ability to control the ball in tight spaces, the ability to defend with any kind of front-footed, aggressive press towards the opposition. Belgium, they look like they were in a training session. They look like they had all the time in the world to think about what they were going to do next with the ball, and they were going to do this, and then they had a genuine plan of attack to target the U.S. weaknesses, which was particularly down the defensive left with Tim Ream and Antonee Robinson, who were dreadful on the day defensively. So I have no idea what happened. It was a rotten performance from start to finish, and it felt like that. It felt even worse in the stadium than it probably felt on TV.
Yeah, it was like the air let out of the stadium real quick.
For sure.
Equalized?
The equalizer was great. Let's be honest, it was a deflection. It was not any kind of reflection of good play. I think at the start of the second half, you're 2-1 down. Honestly, everyone around me in my section was like, we get to halftime at 2-1 down, that's a win, because we just got our ass kicked for 45 minutes. And so you come out in the second half, and they started playing reasonably well, but it all comes completely out with the third goal, and especially the shocking nature of how the goalkeeper comes out. He should probably punt it away. And instead, it just gives away a completely amateurish goal instead. And that just completely lets out all air of the build. And there are the half-hearted attempts at USA chance and half-hearted attempts. Oh, maybe we can get something. But it felt pretty clear that the game was only going one way. And I think there was a real depression, especially amongst the people that watch this, that are diehard fans, that want soccer to grow in this country, that realize, and now we know the numbers, 42 million people were watching that. 42 million people watched the United States get absolutely demolished, and every bit of goodwill has seemingly gone as a result of that performance.
You mentioned, Witty, that you know the U.S. couldn't apply the pressure moving forward, and I think what stood out to me and you as well, most people, through the first couple games was their ability to just control the midfield, and that's what led to that attack style and really what led to them being able to take advantage of mistakes from the other side. What was it that Belgium did that took that element of the game out from the U.S.? Or was it more so that the moment was too big and they just couldn't execute what had been working for them the entire tournament?
It's genuinely hard to know. It's genuinely hard to know because from watching the game, it looked like they just didn't have the level of physicality required to do that, nor even the desire to do that. I almost wonder, we don't know what it was like behind the scenes, but I almost wonder if the coach, Pochettino, decided, we're going to zag. Everyone thinks that we're going to go out there and press them. We're going to back off a little bit, and we're going to try and force them to play, but they're too good. They're too good to allow them room to play. Any player at any kind of high level, when given space, when given time, can do something. And I think that if it was the approach, seems like it was way off. But even beyond that, it was just the fact that this Belgium team was not any kind of overawed. And it seems like from everything they've said afterwards, they were really upset about how, frankly, the U.S., you know, sort of pundit class decided that the U.S. are better than Belgium. And then, of course, what happened with the Balogun thing with the suspension being revoked, it really seemed like the U.S. would have been better off with Ricardo Pepi playing in the game and feeling aggrieved than Fuller and Balogun playing in the game and feeling like everyone hates them and feeling like the other team was really upset at what was going on. So whatever happened behind the scenes for that to happen, whether it was the president, whether it was U.S. soccer, whether it was Infantino who decided, let's have Balogun play in this game, for as much as I actually thought he was the only player on the pitch that actually acquitted himself well, it seemed like that whole storyline and that whole idea led to this sort of sapping of positivity and good feeling. I have no idea if that was the reason why they played like that, but something happened that is not explainable by their ability as players. Because so, whether it's the moment or whatever, something got to them.
So what do we do as the post-mortem for the U.S. in the World Cup? Do we take the positive view of, hey, this is as good a performance as we've seen in a long time? In totality, it's hard to say that, I know, coming off of Monday night. Or is it like, yeah, same old stuff?
Yeah, there definitely is an element of same old stuff, because ultimately, they were the first good team that the U.S. played. And that the Gulf. So I think the U.S. has sort of progressively taken steps. And I think right now you could say that they're in a class of, let's call it the third tier of teams in the world. There are the World Cup contenders and the World Cup previous winners. Right now, I'd say that group is probably only France, Spain, England, Argentina. Then there are high-level teams from South America and Europe, which you can say are your Brazils, your Germanys, even Norway now obviously is in that class. Morocco is in that class. There, you know, probably seven to eight teams that are in that next year. And then the U.S. is in that next group, 13 to let's call it 20, where they're a good team. They can beat teams that they're better than. But ultimately, the chasm between them and the best teams is massive even still. And that was the part that I think we wanted to see close of this World Cup, which I really thought they had a chance to do against Belgium with how Belgium had looked at this tournament. But Belgium are a team full of players that play high-level European football that have all been sold for 30 or 40 million euros, dollars, pounds, whatever you want to call it. Some of them way more than that. And they are established great players that are leaders in their teams. And the U.S. has a bunch of players that are also playing at high levels, but aren't the leaders in their teams. They aren't the best players in their teams. And that's the next step. But unfortunately, that next step sounds easy. It's incredibly hard. There's a reason why only 8 teams have ever won this thing and why trying to work your way into that class of teams is so hard. So the postmortem is you have to treat it as if it's every other failure that they've had in the World Cup, that you have to start over again, that you have to think about the system, you know, pay to play, get it. You know, there's been a lot of talk today, at least on my algorithms, about how do you get players that frankly are in lower socioeconomic statuses or people who, you know, that work in families that make $50,000 or less. Landon Donovan had this great quote that to play in club soccer, organized club soccer in this country, that only 2% of the people that play organized club soccer come from households with an income of less than $50,000. And that's just not what sports is. Sports at every level is people who are trying to rise above their circumstance through amazing athletic talent to get into a different part of life. Yes, there are some rich kids that make it, no question, but that's not what sports is. And so I think there's a real impetus to try and fix systemic problems, which remain problems even if they had beaten Belgium, but at the very least you feel a little bit better about them. So maybe this is better for that reason, that you don't think that you've solved anything in the last 4, 8, 12 years, whatever time frame you want to call it.
I was going to ask you about that because that's what my algorithm has been as well. And I think there's a large conversation and even, you know, broadcasters and former players, you mentioned Landon Donovan, they've been weighing in. But Witty, do you actually see a pathway to changing the current model in the United States? Because the reality is the powers that be who profit from it aren't just going to turn around and say, oh, well, we lost to Belgium. Okay, we'll step back now, take our millions, maybe billions of dollars in some instances, and go build your association football model that could ultimately in 20, 30 years be the difference between the U.S. competing at this level or not.
I don't know, because usually the answer means that someone has to give away money, and that doesn't seem likely. And by the way, this is not a uniquely soccer problem increasingly. I think if you look at basketball, where a lot of the best players in the NBA are not from the United States of America, and AAU is getting similarly expensive, I think this problem is coming to that sport as well. When there are, obviously in American football, there aren't countries that compete with us. In, you know, baseball, there is some competition, but, you know, baseball is still, you know, a sport that the U.S. dominates at. In sports in which you have to compete on a global scale, I think our youth sports model, which is to extract money from rich parents and from people who have dreams of, you know, their kid making it someday, and it turns into a billion-dollar industry, that ain't going to work. It ain't going to work if you want to compete on a global scale. But I just don't know who gives away money in that situation.
Could we fund it through more hydration breaks?
I mean, someone's got to. Someone's got to. It has to be a borderline charity for some people. And I just don't see that happening. I have a colleague who I work with at CBS who was telling me that he used to run a summer camp to help teach kids in his area about the game and to help grow the game and develop the game. And so he runs this summer camp. He wants to run it at a cheaper cost than the other summer camps in the area. Immediately a red flag for everyone around him. All the other competing clubs that run their own summer camps go, well, you're not allowed to promote your summer camps at our places where there are active soccer players. Okay, so what do? I go parent to parent. And so he has like a group of parents that want to get involved, want to get their kid involved in this summer camp. And so he asks them, can you please tell other parents about my summer camp? And they said, no, I like the level of coaching that I get in a more intimate environment. So this guy who used to play professional soccer has so much to impart, has been chewed up and spit out. He doesn't run the summer camp anymore because he got chewed up and spit out by economic models and by parents who have dreams of their kids going pro someday. And that happens to a lot of people. That is not a unique story from people that I've talked to that work around the game, that have been around the game. And so, unfortunately, it has to be in our financial interest for us to get good at soccer. And with the current structures that are there, it just isn't. The only ones that I think are actually putting the work in are professional high-level clubs like an MLS and USL that can make money on selling players abroad. Those clubs that have invested in their academies, that have sold players for multiple million dollars, that retain a percentage sell-on that they can make even more money, those are the clubs that are producing players that are currently in our national team. Clubs like Philadelphia Union, New York Red Bulls, that have made a model out of this and they make money off of it. But if you're not financially incentivizing people to do this, I don't know what that answer is. I really don't.
And other clubs, Witty, I can speak from experience. Like my two nephews tried to get into the Inter Miami Academy, and other clubs like Inter Miami have tried to replicate this model, but there's Inter Miami Academy where you want your youth players playing at because that's the level you want them to play at. And then there's, hey, they didn't make that team, but pay me $3,000 and they'll suit up in the same uniform and look like they play for Inter Miami Academy as well. So like it gets a little complicated.
It's amateur sports in America. I mean, yeah. Anybody who's involved in youth sports. I mean, if you want your kids to play on the volleyball teams, they've got to be with the private coaches. They've got to be on the travel teams, whatever. It's an incredible expense.
I saw someone today on Twitter. I forget what, I think it was in Virginia somewhere. It was an under nines team, And it's $3,300 to play for the season. Yeah. Who the hell is that for? And who from that environment is going to be able to actually make it in a real way that's hungry, that's starving to go have success? Like, instead, those kids who don't make it there are going to choose other sports. And that's what happens. So unless someone is financially incentivized for that to change, I don't know, man. You're tilting at windmills here.
Chris Whittingham from CBS and Apple TV. Real quick, we're out of time. You've heard of Virgil van Dijk?
Yes, I have.
All right, just checking. VVD.
What was the litmus test here?
It's just his birthday, and yeah. I had never heard of him. And
I called him one of the most famous athletes in the world. And Hawk's response:
I said he was not top 50.
Not top 50.
That actually is plausible. I think among soccer fans, I don't know. We'd have to work on a list of soccer players. Soccer players would comprise probably the lion's share of the most popular 50 athletes in the world, but I'm not certain that Van Dijk quite gets there.
Yeah,
but he's definitely around there. He's around there.
Messi, Mbappe, Erling Haaland. I mean,
I'm not putting him on that level. I didn't say top five. But then, of Liverpool.
Yeah, but then you have to start getting down to American sports as well, right?
LeBron James.
You do. LeBron James, yeah. Victor Wembanyama.
But he's
Matis Buzelis. What? All right. Thank you, Witty.
Yeah, cheers, guys.